I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet today and pay my respects to the elders past and present. Before I hand back to Heather to facilitate the event, I would like to take time just to say a few words, and I will keep it brief because we've got lots to discuss this afternoon. I'd like to thank our sponsors, McCullough Robertson, who have also been with us for the past 11 years, and it was at that time that Heather and I got together when Heather was with McCullough Robertson, and they have been our sponsors ever since. So thank you so much, Aaron, for continuing that relationship with us, and we actually hope that you'll continue it into the future too. I'm exceedingly proud to tell you that we are the leaders of recruitment within the non-profit sector, and we have been for many years. We place from junior right through to the most senior within the organisation, the chairs and the board members. We've been doing that for quite some time. It's by running events such as this, where we invest our profits back into the non-profit sector, that we qualify as a social enterprise. So we're a for-profit, for-purpose social enterprise. And we turn 20 today. Thank you. It was 20 years ago today that I opened the doors of Windsor Recruitment back then. And it was level 1, 324 Queen Street, with a receptionist. And here we are today. I would never have dreamed that we would get to this point of working with such an incredible sector that we love working with and we hope to continue working with into the future. So now, I'd like to formally introduce my good friend and supporter, Heather Watson. Heather, as many of you would know, is a non-executive director and chair of a number of organisations. She is incredibly passionate about leadership and excellence and contributing to improving the outcomes for people and communities. And she has the opportunity to do this, to make such a contribution through a portfolio of roles, including the chair and board member of community service agencies, the Uniting Church in New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania and Northern Territory, is a board member of Queensland Rail, board member of Children's Health Queensland, a board member of National Affordable Housing Consortium, the chair of EPIC Good Foundation, and an advisory board of the ACNC, the Australian Charities and Nonprofits Commission. So as you can see, we are in very good hands this afternoon. So please welcome Heather back to the lectern. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dillis. I joined your words of acknowledgement by paying my respects as well to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Yagara and Turrbal peoples, and to recognise their elders past, present, and those emerging leaders who collectively we would want to continue to support, because it's with those efforts to protect and promote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture that there will be a lasting legacy for which the whole of the community will benefit. In practical terms, if there is an emergency, and I'm assured that there won't be, we'll follow the directions and we'll use the exits to find our way out. Restrooms are outside the door, and I'm sure you'll find, I think the gentlemen are in the closest and the ladies are just a little bit further around the corner. On the slide, if you can read the text at the bottom, there's a mobile phone, so that you do have the opportunity to think about questions that come up from the conversation this morning, just to text the questions through, which will be collated, and we will have a point to pause and reflect on the questions, and then I'll be able to redirect those questions to the panel through part of the process. And we've certainly found from past years that interaction and feedback has been most appreciated. So it's my great pleasure to introduce our three guest speakers, and I'll ask them to come and join me at the table. And while I do that, I'll give you their quick bios, although I was really chuffed by reading and reminding myself around the great contribution that each of them have made and continue to make. So Anna Marston is the Managing Director of the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, and through that Anna's one of the leading voices in the protection of the Great Barrier Reef. Her role involves securing key investments from government and philanthropic stakeholders for the foundation, and she's driven a record fundraising growth, ensuring commitment to new projects and research that will continue to protect and restore the reef. She brings, though in addition to that role, 20 years of experience in spearheading organisations in the particularly not-for-profit creative industries that really are the Australia's leading icons, including her leadership with a CEO of Queensland Ballet, with Queensland's Gallery of Modern Art, and the Institute of Modern Art General Manager. She's also held board positions with Brisbane Festival, Brisbane Powerhouse, and Circa. And one of the things I learned about Anna in my research is that her leadership has been recognised both through the Institute of Management's Not-for-Profit Manager of the Year back in 2013, which is also a Winston Churchill Memorial Fellowship Scholar and a Young Arts Manager of the Year. So join me with welcoming Anna. I might describe Mike as the rose amongst the thorns, would that be right? So Mike brings a very significant experience to his current roles, which include significantly as chair and director of a number of organisations. So he chairs the board of Boyce Chartered Accountants and chairs the West Moreton Health Hospital and Health Service. He's provided significant leadership across the health sector as chair of the Queensland Health Board Chairs Forum. That's a forum I would describe Mike as herding cats, would that be right?
Absolutely.
Yep. He's also deputy chair of the National Injury Insurance Scheme here in Queensland and brings a portfolio of governance experience both in the not-for-profit sector, the finance sector and education sector. So welcome, Mike. And finally, but not at all at least, Tracy Adams, who's the CEO of Your Town. And in that role, Tracy has more than 30 years' experience with Your Town in various roles and was appointed their Chief Executive Officer in 2008. Since being appointed to her current position, and just a reminder that Your Town is based here in Brisbane but operates nationally, she's directed significant company growth, including an operating budget increase of more than $40 million, a client increase of more than 100%, and greatly enhanced an advocacy platform for those experiencing social exclusion, as well as significantly an organisational name change. Boys Town, Your Town? And of course, you'll see Tracy in many government inquiries, policy shifts, and she's a very significant voice in many of those forums. In addition to her executive role, she has a number of board positions, and including brings a perspective as an executive advisor to QUT's Executive MBA program. So join with me with welcoming Tracy. So in preparing for today's session, I've also, as Dilys has reflected on the last 11 years where we've been providing this forum with the topic Sparks Around the Boardroom. It's been a terrific partnership between Windsor and Nicola Robertson, but I've reflected on the evolution of what were, you know, the big topics for us 11 years ago, and what were we seeing the future was going to hold for, particularly for not-for-profits and charities. At that time, I think we were just at the cusp of not-for-profits and charities being identified as having a distinct and recognisable role in the landscape of operations and governance. There was the emergence of the ACNC, and I recall that there were year by year about, were we going to have a charities regulator or weren't we? And you know, the conversation sort of went round and round. And for those of you that have been involved in this forum right back since the beginning, we almost yearly had the attendance of David Locke, the Assistant Commissioner for the ACNC. So we had the opportunity to have a real lens into that first role that the Charities Commission was taking very much in its educative that phase. And it's been really interesting to me that, of course, David's gone on to become, to use that well experienced, they earned through the ACNC to become the financial ombudsman. So perhaps from frying pan to fire, one might say. In addition to the evolving role of the Charities Commission, there's also been very significant reviews about many of the activities that not-for-profits and charities have undertaken. And so you might, many of you will have contributed to or reflected on Productivity Commission recommendations across a number of the industries that our charities and not-for-profits operate in. The tax office seems to have gone through a period where there was a very significant year-by-year review after review after review about whether the tax concession framework was going to continue, whether it was going to change. It's gone into a bit of a hiatus, but I won't be a predictor of saying that I don't think it's gone away very far. There's also been a very significant shift in the way in which consumer and customers have become more precedent in the way in which we need to operate in terms of funding models and service models. We've had and continue to have three Royal Commissions whose remit has significantly impacted on the Not-for-Profit and Charitable Commission, and we're continuing to really contemplate where that might go. And so if we think about that quite dynamic context over the last 11 years, and we think about what our title, Sparks Around the Boardroom, might mean for us, I think there's probably two areas of focus for us. One is around what are the sparks that are that represent the challenges that we need to most focus on? And secondly, what's the spark which reflects the dynamic between CEO and board as we think about that dynamic? So, over to the hard work of our contributors. We've picked three broad areas that we're going to talk about today, and you might reflect on those as we elicit some questions around each of those. The first is in the area of culture, the second is in the area of strategy, and the third is in the area of board and executive dynamics. So turning firstly to culture, which seems to be a very common conversation in many governance circles, whether we're talking about not-for-profits or in the broader environment. It was interesting that last month the Institute of Company Directors and the Ethics Centre, based in Sydney, released a guide called Ethics in the Boardroom. And in that guide, it calls out the importance of not only positive organisational culture, but also what they describe as the collective culture and character of the board. So I guess my first general question for our panel members to think about is that a real dynamic, that is, culture of the organisation being separate and distinct from culture of the board, or do we see them related in some way? And then I guess related to that is, do you see it helpful as having an ethical lens when we think about culture, and perhaps some experiences from your own context as to the role that an ethical perspective plays when culture's emerging? So, who'd like to start? Emma.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I absolutely see the culture of the board and the culture of the organisation as connected. I think if you were looking at different dynamics and different cultures, I think you're going to hit issues early on. I think for us, I mean, and I don't want to spend the whole every time it comes to me talk about our last 12 months, but we've had a pretty interesting 12 months, which has placed a not-for-profit under an intense scrutiny that it wasn't ready for. And had to shoulder a lot of responsibility and accountability, sort of political sort of worthy level of accountability. And it was an absolute test of culture around the boardroom, but also around the organisation. And there were a number of really interesting reflections and learnings from that, which have made us now a stronger, better organisation, and I guess more attuned to culture moving forward. And the big aha that we had was that the people who choose to work in not-for-profits in purpose-led work, and the individuals who choose to volunteer their time and sit around the board table in not-for-profits do it because the cause or social good speaks to them. And to do that, you have to have a thin skin. You know, you're not a robot. You feel challenges in society. You feel that you must give back. And so you can't have a thin skin and a thick skin at the same time. To have a thin skin means you also feel, you know, the ickiness of bullying and challenging workplaces. You feel, you know, the arrows that might come to you when you hit a crisis. And so therefore, I think in not-for-profits, culture and the proactive management and fostering of effective, ethical, powerful, high-performing cultures is so much more important in not-for-profits because our people feel it first. And how are we to ask them to put themselves in the line and give everything for this work if the workplace itself is not a nurturing culture? So for me, it's a non-negotiable. It's one of the KPIs that I have to work within, and it's a reporting KPI that the board looks at very closely. We've tried very hard in the last year to sophisticate our employee engagement metrics and model them on what some large, you know, multi-dimensional organisations have to ensure that we can see things that are emerging, because what drives me from a culture perspective is very different to what drives an 18-year-old. And you've got to make sure that you've got a system that works around all of that. But I think to answer your question, I think they are connected. I think they must be ethically driven. And I think that if you lose sight of that or take your eye off that, you may be able to move along and do great work, but when something hits you from surprise, you will feel that you do not have that strong foundation.
Thanks, Anna. Tracy?
Well, I would agree. I think that absolutely the board and the organisation should have the same culture. But I think there's a far more focus applied often on what the organisational culture is and the measurements for that. And do they actually get translated into the boardroom, I think, is the question perhaps we do need to be considering. Culture will be your protection point when things do go wrong. And the real value of culture is when you know how to act when things aren't on track. And sometimes we think about culture as being something very soft. I certainly agree we need to have a culture that nurtures people. But culture, for me, in my own experience, has really come to the fore when things go terribly wrong. We've had Royal Commissions that have highlighted behaviours from the past that should never have been allowed to happen, and organisations today have to operate in a new environment because of that. But you have to be able to do what is right, because intrinsically that is the way your organisation behaves, that's what you stand for. And so all the work that you put into culture effectively becomes the thing that gets you through those times. It becomes your go-to place. And so I think you've got to keep focused on, yes, you want to create an environment of positivity, but that's almost like your deposit for the future of something that you need to draw upon. And for me, I think it is so worthy of investing time, of energy, of focus, of measurement, and understanding where you're at, where you aspire to be, and really about making sure you get the right people coming into your organisation who are buying into that culture, both in the boardroom, but in your organisation, and what metrics do we use when we appoint directors or very senior leaders around, are they the right fit for culture?
I sort of concur with everything you said, what both of you said, and you're right with it. But it's a case of should be and is, and they're often very, very different. In organisations, particularly large organisations, there's a board and leadership culture, but there's often a sort of subterranean culture. It often happens with long-serving middle management. And this was brought home to me yesterday. We were talking to a group of consumers of healthcare services, public and other providers, and they made the point that's where the challenge is for lots of organisations. If we think we haven't got cultural black spots in our organisations, we as directors and chief executives kidding ourselves. So we have to work very hard at identifying that, and you have to, you know, you have to articulate it at the board level and the leadership level constantly, and talk about what's important to care for the team, and to actually then not just articulate but live it, lead it, make sure that people who go through difficult times in the team get cared for. You need to enforce it. You need to enforce it in the organisation with disciplinary action at times to say that's not the way we do things around here, and you, that behaviour will not be acceptable. And a great lesson that those of you who were anybody at the ROCD director's briefing recently will have heard Graham Bradley speak about the value of his what he called the cultural dashboard, which I thought was a terrific concept that boards and executives should have. So the data that gives you a sense of what things are happening, what is happening in your organisation, that's not filtered by management filters. So, you know, turnover of staff, consumer surveys, staff sentiment surveys. I love that he said, ask your staff, how well does our organisation live by its values? Ask all of your staff members that question. And then ask them, how well do we treat our customers or our consumers or clients in what we do, and find out, get that test regularly, and that will inform your board thinking. So there's a few thoughts about aligning culture to ethical standards.
Thanks, Mike. That's really good. In fact, it reminds me, there was a Bernard Salt article just a couple of weeks ago where he was sort of saying, if you really think your client, your customer-centric, you know, actually go to your website and look at how hard or easy it is to navigate. And I confess to being, you know, one of those, particularly a customer in a number of contexts, being totally frustrated about, you know, not being able to find a real person or a real pathway. So, you know, that was a kind of a real wake-up call. But I guess one of the comments I want to pick up, Tracy, you particularly mentioned that we seem to be, you know, reasonably okay at starting to measure culture of the organisation, but should we also be trying to measure culture around the board? And of course, that's a bit more challenging. But I wondered if any of you have got experience of any activities or processes that might be an indicator of how you test or measure for culture around the board.
Well, I think it's critical, because if you've got dysfunctional behaviours around the board, you cannot run the organisation effectively. So you have to get that right. As a board chair, I've seen it. Dysfunctional boards, and as a consultant in that area, I've seen very, very dysfunctional boards. But when it's happening well and there are good behavioural dynamics in the board, which reflect the ethics and culture of the board, that's right. So how do you measure that? How do you get that right? This goes perhaps a little bit to some of the questions that you asked a little later on. Sorry if I'm jumping
in.
But actually surveying board members, questioning them about in a regular board review, every now and again do that externally, but ask the board members about the behaviours around the table. There ought to be enough people with a moral compass to be able to tell you if there are unacceptable behaviours, and then to work through that and find out what the dynamics are. And if it's happening regularly with one or more directors, that needs to be a very difficult conversation to the chair. It's not much fun, but that's the tone from the top.
Mm, that's good. I think that issue that we've largely had to deal with for boards in the sector has been good people come to the board, they're not remunerated, they give their time, so they don't necessarily want to be having tough conversations with them, and I think this is a natural tension point. Absolutely, the dynamic of the boardroom is so critical, but you can have really good people with great skills who come together and the dynamic doesn't work. And that's where the challenge, I think, lies, in being able to manage. And the chair, I think, in particular, is put in a position where he's got a well-meaning groups of individuals or one or two people, and it's not working. And they can't see it, and we all have people in our organisations that sometimes don't have the same levels of self-awareness or the dynamic's not there. And I think this is a real tension point in boards that operate with well-meaning individuals, but when it's not working, there's really no strong indicators to say this needs to now happen.
So I echo what everyone said. We don't have anything formal except, you know, annual reviews, but when you look at the board dynamic,
you often don't need to do a survey monkey to understand. I mean, it's often an intimate room of, you know, 5 to 12 people. You can see when there's interesting characters and personalities and things that are not working. I think it goes to, and again, jumping to one of the later conversations, if you don't have a constructive relationship between executive and chair, which essentially in that room have the most stake, if they can't have a conversation and go, this is not working, then you're going to have bigger issues as well. So I think it all echoes from the role of a chair and of why we're really here. Yes, these are well-meaning, wonderful people, and we're so grateful for their time and their skills, but these are also businesses. Sometimes the not-for-profit, you know, badge makes us think we're doing something else here, but a lot of us are running multi-million dollar organisations, and so we need to be held up to the same accountability that other multi-million dollar organisations are doing, and that comes down to board behaviour and focusing on the right things and getting the job done.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So we'll circle back to some of those dynamics that we were talking about, but I think it's interesting to call out that there's the potential for a cultural incongruence if we're, on the one hand, the board is being required to hold the organisation to account, but not being prepared to hold itself to account. So we might pick that up again in a little bit.
That's the tone from the top.
Yeah.
Yourself, and expect everyone else.
Exactly. So we might move on to the next topic, which is that of strategy. And you may have all heard the phrase, culture eats strategy for breakfast, which was a Peter Drucker statement, I think, from 20 years ago. But I actually, in my research for today, found an article that was headed, Culture Eats Strategy for Breakfast. So what's for lunch? So let's move on to lunch, which is strategy. So again, it's been timely for us in holding this event at this time of year, but it's usually fairly fresh after the Institute of Company Directors have issued their annual not-for-profit governance and performance study, which they did do about a month or so ago. And interestingly, on the issue of strategy, one of the findings that they identified relating to board performance was that directors rated highly relatively their board's performance, but directors surveyed saw that strategic planning and implementation as areas for improvement. So the commentary goes on, ensuring their organisation diversifies income sources and navigates a changing operating environment are short-term priorities. Longer term, the focus is on improving the board's oversight of strategy formulation and execution. So there's a couple of concepts I think identified in that summary. One is, what are the short-term strategic challenges versus the long-term? And perhaps the question, a question for our panel members, you know, how important is it to have longer-term strategies when, you know, we work in such a dynamic and fast-changing environment? Is that kind of not so relevant? We just should be focusing on the short-term. And I guess the other one relates to strategy that might be requiring us to shift and diversify. So, and if I name a particular issue, two of you particularly have got organisations very strongly focused on fundraising, and inevitably there are some tensions around what's the role of the board versus executive, so that might also be an element to pick up. Mark, do you want to perhaps kick off this time?
I'm happy to kick off and start on the strategy. Yep. I'm less skilled in fundraising than I am. Has anyone been at a not-for-profit board strategic planning workshop and then walk out of the room at the end of the day and you can almost feel management breathe a sigh of relief, say, thank God we've done that for another year. We can shut the book on that. Because I have seen with lots of organisations that we do this great strategic planning, and then we sort of leave it on the desk or leave it on the bench for another 12 months, and we might refer to it occasionally when we need justification for doing something we want to do, but we don't actually let that become the playbook for our year, our 2 and 3 year plan. It doesn't drive what we do. And that's, if I look at enterprises, both for profit, not for profit, and government, that fail in strategy, as that survey indicates, that would be overwhelmingly the cause of failure. The failure to turn the strategic direction and plan into concrete actions, milestones and objectives, and then to hold management to account for it, and then to keep adapting and driving it. And I think that might be the big secret, Heather, because, you know, after a number of scars on the back. I'm starting to learn that that's how you actually make strategy work for your organisation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks,
Mike. I would agree. If you don't have the playbook, strategy's nothing. So I think what's really critical is understanding then what you're going to be expecting your organisation to report on. If you don't know where you're going, you're not going to know how where you get there, you're not going to understand your impact measures. They've all got to be considered in the development of a strategy. And I think there's got to be short-term and some longer-term visionary. But we've got to also accept, I think, technology advances. You know, we've got to be mindful of, we set a 20-year plan. 20 years from now will look so different. So we've got to be realistic about the environment we're operating in. I think the critical element is to set a strategy that then becomes part of what your organisation is all about. So the business planning, the KPIs, the reporting to the board, the development of new programs, whatever it might be, all have to be reported back through a strategy playbook in that context. So it actually becomes part of your organisation. Not a lovely booklet that sits on your website that you hand out to prospective donors or corporate partners or government to say, this is what we're all about, but behind the scenes everybody's off doing whatever they want. No. I would make one point. Yes, the board have to make the management responsible and accountable. The board also have to be accountable for keeping strategy on track. If they simply hand it over to their CEO, you know, I don't think that's good enough on their behalf.
I mean, strategy is everything, because it is a dynamic space that we're in and it changes, but we need to have something on the horizon that we're aiming for. Otherwise, how do we know what success is? What is our ambition? And what really, why do we get to sit in these seats? You know, these are privileged seats, and if you can't move these organizations and serve these causes in these powerful moments of time, then, you know, get off and let someone else to do it. I think one of the things that we've tried really hard is to not make strategy one tier of leadership's responsibility. It's not, I mean, I'm a strategy junkie, but it's not just my responsibility and the board's responsibility. We try very hard to activate through our different working committees opportunities to really own a piece of strategy and drive that, and then when it comes back and being the champions of that implementation, we activate our director level, our second tier membership, to take on and self-select two strategic initiatives with a five-year horizon and be completely accountable for that and come and report to the board. Because the thing is that you want ownership. You actually want everyone to make sure that they're looking up to what's happening today, but you want everyone to have one eye, or at least a squint of an eye, looking 2 or 3 years down the horizon. So if it's only one person who's owning it, if it's only 2 or 3 directors, you have a flip of personnel and the strategy dies. How do you truly get an organisation, all systems going, really churning along the way? And we've found that's paid off in significant dividends, because we've been ready for an opportunity to come knocking, because we've built the organisation in anticipation of something we can't even see.
Great. So if we assume that one of the strategies that a fictitious organisation might be wanting to pursue is other income streams, and given that you could be an organisation that already relies significantly on fundraising, or you could be an organisation that hasn't traditionally relied on that, but perhaps that could be something to add into the toolkit. How do you help your board get their head around that? Because often your board might well have been appointed for other reasons. I mean, it might be full of lawyers, for example. They're not necessarily good fundraisers. But how do you make that shift? Because it's not just words on a page. You've actually got to think about what different skill sets do we need, both organisationally and across the board. So any insights?
I think it comes back to that earlier point about, you know, a shared vision and a shared strategy. If in the strategy what spits out is diversification of revenue, and to ensure that we can sort of smooth out some of the bumpiness and lumpiness of funding, or we don't have security over government grants moving forward, then there is a level of ownership with that board, but that is something that we've got to move in. Now, you know, you've then got to make a decision about the skill sets of your board, and I think typically once you've reset a new strategic vision, you do the skills matrix review and make sure you plug in the gaps. But certainly, I mean, from our perspective, we have a board that has a lot of science and it has a lot of serious ASX 100 sort of directors on it for a reason. There's no point us either growing our board to 60 to compensate and have a lot of fundraisers, or to basically say, get out of the pool, we want to replace you with someone who's wealthy and can, you know, can give or get off kind of thing. So then you set up a committee or a working group and you report it up. You know, you have to iterate the system and build the house around what you're doing. And that way then you can help people who have a clear purpose, because it's a heavy load, and no one wants to sit in a boardroom and go for 16 hours covering every single thing. So I think it comes back to that really clear point. What is the purpose of your board? Where is the organisation going? And do you need to sort of have a different kind of architecture of support advisors to take the organisation where it can get? What's great about that is you can flip in and out of those committees. They can be really nimble. And they, you know, can meet only two or three times a year, and they can be bigger, and they can really focus on something that's quite a critical metric or success point for the organisation without having to be burdened with all the bigger governance issues as well. So we've found that quite successful.
I think fundraising is an enabler to an end goal. And so when we think about that in the context of strategy, what is the end goal that the organisation wants to achieve? And fundraising becomes an element towards that. If I use my own organisation as an example, we had a strategy set many years ago that said the organisation would never be more funded by government than what it generates for itself. Clear strategic intent. So what did that mean for the organisation? Well, we had to develop the mechanics, the structure to achieve that particular intent. So fundraising was an end goal about independence, about having not one reliance on one particular income stream, to allow the organisation to always have the stability of a funding source that was diverse. That was the strategic intent. A lot of organisations, I have a sense, and when people come speak to me about this, is that they've been told, we want to diversify our income. Go out and do fundraising. What's your end goal? What's the strategic intent that your board have as a vision for your organisation? Because that will aid your fundraising modelling development. That will aid you identifying who the skills are, what your potential strategy for that's going to be, who are your target audiences, how are you going to build that. If it's simply about, we need fundraising, go and hire yourself a fundraiser, I'm sorry, I think the board need to be more thinking about what is the end goal.
I'm hesitant to speak because I've not been directly involved in fundraising or that sort of skill set. But
you're the classic director that needs to be shifted, Mike, so how do we do that?
I think that you asked a question a little earlier about the value of long-term strategy and direction, and you're right. You know, you don't know what technology platforms or what environments you're going to be operating in 5 years, let alone 10, 20 or 30 years. But if you've got that clearly articulated vision and a clarity around what your organisation does really well and wants to continue to do really well, and a couple of long-term drivers, that sets you a long game plan. And it's like a 4 or 5 year plan to win the World Cup. You've just got to start very early and have a clear vision. And that gold cup sitting on your trophy cabinet is part of what you need to engage everybody in thinking about.
Mm-hmm. So just perhaps coming back to, Tracy, your challenge about having where's the vision that you can then match with it, I want to come back to this long-term planning, because I think, you know, our traditional cycles of planning, you know, 5 years, maybe 10 years, has been challenging enough. Tracy, I think you mentioned a sort of at least perhaps a 20-year horizon. I know that UnitedCare Queensland, within the family of organisations I'm involved in, has just gone through a 30-year strategic planning process, and just from being on the edges, I think how painful that must have been. But I think one of the things that it does do is that if you do have this, you know, vision for, well, we think we're going to be here at whatever stage, and working backwards from that, it really, I think, crystallises that, well, actually, business as usual is not going to get us there. So I think it's that challenge around really hard to do, but is it a mechanism that helps to, you know, crystallise the action that's required?
I think it's about having as much knowledge about what you see coming down the line, and when this particular vision restatement was made about the independence of funding, you know, more than a decade ago, we were already seeing that government funding was going to change. We were already seeing a different type of focus, and so you have to be taking that knowledge on board and saying, what is it going to mean? What will it mean for our mission, for the way we want to operate, for the vision we have for our organisation, for the work we do. And that starts to then utilise. I really don't think you can have multiplicity of these sorts of long-term goals because it's a changing environment. But you can take on board what you see coming down the line and start to think about what you're going to do to start shifting your own model to accommodate that. But in the space of technology, I think that's a far more challenging space. But today, even there, we can use technology for so much productivity gains, and fundraising is an area that benefits significantly from technology.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think it is that dynamic of what a strategic plan is and what an operational plan is, mm-hmm. and that the strategic plan is quite visionary. And you can, you know, you report to it, but you don't expect it to fall that way. I mean, the funny thing for us is that we put to bed a 10-year strategic plan with the board, and then 2 days later got a call from the then Prime Minister with $500 million, and that wasn't in the plan.
So you can contemplate saying no. We won't go there.
Well, our board member said to us, you say no, this is yours, so you know, there are many Michelle's I couldn't.
No, no.
I think the thing was, though, that we all had a good joke about, well, that plan's done, we met all the targets. But it was interesting because once we got through the next 3 months and then the 3 months after that and then even a few more, we rose from that and looked at our plan and went, actually, all the strategic drivers ring true. The vision is great, the metrics are gone, the KPIs from a numbers perspective and also from the fact that now government are a significant investor and blah, blah, blah. But the vision and the strategy is still true. And that was a really interesting moment of reflection of the pathway and the plan that's true, even with a significant jerk of something or a fairy godmother moment. It doesn't change what the cause that we all serve needs you to be as an organisation, and it doesn't change too much about the strategy. It just might make it a little bit more colourful or add a different dynamic to it. Yeah, fun story.
That's good. Just a reminder that if the conversation is prompting any questions for you, please text the number and we'll gather those shortly as we have a break. But let's lead on to the third broad area, which was in the area of board and executive dynamics. And again, this was a reflection back to the AICD's not-for-profit governance and performance study, and there were three findings that I picked out of that survey that I think is relevant to this topic. The first one was a reflection on the time commitment that directors were reporting that they were making, and posing the question, is it sustainable? Because the survey found that directors are devoting extra time to each of their not-for-profit board roles, and that this had been a consistent trend over the last 5 years of the study. So as in other sectors, not-for-profit board workloads are rising as regulatory and community expectations of boards increase and as governance becomes more complex. So that's one area around time commitment. The second finding was around board composition and director recruitment. And again, there was reporting of ongoing challenges for not-for-profit boards continuing to comprise mostly of older directors, with 77% over 50 and only 5% under 40, based on survey responses. Directors reported that some not-for-profit boards have found it hard to recruit younger directors, and that a lack of stakeholder representatives on their board remains an issue. And then finally, and probably connected to both of those findings, was on the issue of not-for-profit director remuneration, where is it heading? And so what was reported is that there has been little change in the proportion of not-for-profits that pay board fees despite rising workloads and risks. Some directors believe greater debate is needed on whether not-for-profits should pay a board fee or increase their current remuneration rates. So across that sort of broad spectrum, one of the kind of areas that challenged me particularly, because in a number of contexts recently, there's been a dialogue around thinking about the future of your organisation in terms of effectively life's trajectory across three thirds, so first third, second third, third third. And of course in my mental mind, you know, I'm down at the left-hand side of that, but suddenly kind of realised, actually, I'm probably in the third third. And it's only just kind of dawned on me. But I think that is relevant to both the board's perspective and the lens And then, you know, how that lens translates into, you know, the ability of the board to be broad enough and innovative enough for what's ahead. And, you know, the challenge of, does that necessarily mean we should be targeting board members who are in the first third of their life, for example, as a means of trying to sort of break that nexus? So, time commitment, board composition, remuneration, connected or not connected, who'd like to take the challenge?
I can speak a little bit to younger directors, and we had a deliberate strategy a few years ago to, because we are focused on children and young people, wanting to have younger directors who might be part of, you know, the dynamic of the board. And we were able to recruit three exceptionally great young directors, three under the age of about 33, and they were fantastic. But they didn't stay for more than 1.5 terms, probably was about the longest. And largely that was due to their own career and the demands of their own career. And for one of them, it became a conflict of interest because their career took them into a political portfolio. But while they were there, they added a lot of value. And perhaps what we need to be thinking about is, if people add value and they can only be on your board for 3 years or 4 years, maybe that's okay. We've often tended to view boards as being a very long-term commitment to a couple of terms, maybe 3 terms. Now, maybe this needs to change and we are more adaptable to allowing different people to come into the boardroom at different stages of their own careers and add that value. I think the time commitment is real. I see it in my own directors, I see it on boards that I'm in. If you are signing up to a board, you have to be prepared and knowledgeable that this is going to take your time. And it's not just about the boardroom, it's not just about reading papers, it's the time in between of making sure you understand the business that you are a part of. If you only turn up on the board meeting day, and then you only turn up at the DEX board meeting day, you know, I really think you're probably not really grasping what the organisation is framed about. In that context, if we want to continue to position our sector strongly, I think the debate on remuneration has to be had. I think there's been a lot of discussion about, well, good people should give their time for nothing, that's what the community expects, that donor dollar. But what the community expects is our organisations to be run very well, to be held accountable and to achieve outcomes. And if we can prove all of those things, whether we pay directors or not, is secondary to actually delivering on mission.
Look, I think that's right. I've certainly encountered the challenge of making sure you get younger directors and bring in different mindsets. It's fantastic when you get the right people. Occasionally you don't quite get it right, but the different perspective that gets brought to the table. You're right, you don't always keep it for long, and you don't expect to, but the change of thinking, or the different thinking, the modes of thinking, are just terrific to crusty old people like me. But I also don't underestimate the value of experienced older directors. But I think one of the mistakes we make in recruiting experienced directors is, you know, we bring people on board because they've been fantastic at doing their job really well, whether it's lawyers, accountants, business leaders, and what we do is let them continue to run the business. And it's not our job to run the business. It's our job to see the business is done really well. So the challenge that I've got as a chair, and occasionally get pulled up by other chairs, is to say, is to be told, stop telling them what to do. Ask the difficult question, but don't tell them what to do. And so the process of selecting board members, while it can be frustrating to have vacancies on your not-for-profit board, it's better to have a vacant seat than a troublesome director. Far better. So select really carefully. Ask the question, why do you want to be on here? And what value do you think you can add? How do you think you will add that value? Do you have any particular projects or interests that you have? Because the last thing you want is a single issue candidate distracting the board from the organisation's business. But making sure you recruit wisely and discard early would be my advice.
We might come back to the discard early. There's clearly some tips there. And a final comments from you, and then we will have a small break.
Well, I think, you know, to that earlier point about we are operating in a dynamic environment, you know, the board is not a set and forget task.
you don't sign on to it and just think, okay, well, I'll get 10 years out of this group and then we'll get the next one in. But also, when I sat on boards and when I look at the boards that I've worked with, we've been in those rooms and those meetings where every paper is taken as read and you feel like you're just rubber stamping. And then you've been in those rooms where an agenda is given the time and care to have two really interesting strategic matters to be discussed, where, you know, you're bold enough as the executive to go, I don't know the answer to this, and I reckon you'll take me somewhere I don't want to go, but it's an interesting conversation. But it's a two-way street. You value the conversation, you value the input. Otherwise, you're wasting their time and they're wasting yours. And so I think it's about respecting the two roles and really be trying to ensure that everyone is able to bring their A game to it. Now, as a consequence of that, and if there's no cookie cutter approach, it depends on the organisation, the means, and all of that kind of thing about the time commitment, the dynamic, and the audience, and the profile of your board. But I think the worst thing you can do is not continually refine and be open to dynamic changes around the board table. And I think every time, every two or three meetings, you know, there's always something else. Should we have a person like that around the table? What do you think? And I think that's it's alive. It's alive. Ecosystem that play such a pivotal role in these organisations that are alive.
Great. So we might pause there. So join with me in thanking our panel so far. And now it's over.